Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Joshua Friedman, who is a policy analyst in the Economic Growth Program at the New America Foundation, where he researches and writes about economic and social policy in the U.S. He's the author of the new report at newamerica.net, Pay More, Get Less, How American Socioeconomic Policy is Falling Short. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joshua Friedman.
Thank you for having me.
And your new study, I think it's very groundbreaking and, you know, somewhat overdue. And I can only hope that it really reaches the public's consciousness here, because you're really getting into the whole idea of the American dream and the reality of American life as opposed to the dream. I wouldn't go so far as to say nightmare, but the long and the short of it is our impressions of how we are the leading country in the world with a higher standard of living certainly are not supported by the facts, and that across the basic parts of our social contract, such as healthcare, higher education, and retirement, Americans pay more but receive fewer benefits than citizens in other advanced industrialized countries. And the same pattern applies to increasingly important services like banking and the internet. So elaborate, if you will.
Sure, absolutely. So we have this social contract as a society based on wage labor in return for organizing our economy in that way. We have a set of social and economic supports that contribute to a middle class quality of life. And we think of those as healthcare, education, retirement. But additionally, as society grows, some other ones are added to that, like the ability to open a bank account and having access to connections, internet connections, and things like that. And because of the way that we've designed our social and economic programs, which is a very complicated and somewhat regulated, but not all that regulated system, it turns out that we end up paying a lot of money, both at an individual level and at a public level, for these basic goods and services, but are not actually getting that much or as much as we're paying as a result. And you see all the talk about how we spend too much money on this, we spend too much money on that, and that doesn't really get to the heart of the question, which is, what are we actually getting out of it? And one of the things that I was looking at is that we're paying a lot of money, but we're not getting that much. So it can't be a question of us paying too much money. It's a question of how we've designed our systems, how we transmit these benefits to Americans who rely on them increasingly to be the foundation of a middle-class lifestyle.
Well, it seems that we're more invested in the illusion than in the reality because, as you point out, toasters and computers have gotten cheaper and big screen TVs and all of those consumer goods, which people, of course, since the late 1970s, wages have been stagnant, but access to credit has grown. So that's given the people the illusion of a standard of living. However, having the accoutrement or the toys isn't the same as the fact that middle-class families are trapped between low stagnant wages and increasingly expensive set of social and economic supports, as the price of healthcare, higher education, retirement, and other necessities have steadily increased. So that's the bottom line, isn't it? You know, that the real stuff's gotten expensive. We get pay more for less, but we're, you know, for toasters and computers, we pay less. But at the end of the day, that doesn't make a middle class.
Exactly. And one of the common arguments from people who are not very supportive of some of these programs has been that, hey, the middle class is doing just fine. I mean, look at how expensive computers are. They're so much cheaper. They're so much better than they were before. And that's true. But when it comes to the programs that actually make your quality of life better and contribute to economic security, which, as anybody who's in the economy right now can tell you, is tenuous at best, the things that contribute to actual economic security and economic adequacy, those are the things that are getting more expensive or that we're not getting enough results out of the money we spend.
So the real issues are here the need for a safe retirement, an affordable post-secondary education, and affordable health care, of course. And according to the 2014 Social Progress Index, the U.S. ranks 36th in the world in terms of foundations of well-being, which encompass education, health, and information services. So let's go through some of those. I think it's very disturbing statistics, starting with healthcare, where we pay more for healthcare procedures and pharmaceuticals and medical goods. Here's an example that you have in your paper. An individual procedure such as drugs and MRI cost $1,145 on an average in the United States compared to $138 $350 in Switzerland and $350 in Australia. Nexium, which is a common medication, is $215 in the United States, but only $20 to $60 in parts of Europe. And the cost of spending one day in a hospital in the U.S. is about 10 times higher than in Spain and three times higher than in Australia. These are so important, these statistics. But what worries me, Joshua Friedman, is I don't know that the message is getting out there. I don't think our politicians are talking about this. You know, the Republicans always go out there and say that we have the greatest country on earth, and then the Democrats play catch up because they want to be Me Too patriots, and they say the same stuff. So who's educating American people about the reality?
I hope people are reading the paper, but I'm not sure who exactly is thinking about these issues, except to say that when we talk about the America's the best, one of the main defenses of how much money we spend on these programs is that, well, we have higher quality, you know, we get better outcomes. But for the most part, that's actually not true. In some cases, like higher education, our very top universities, the ones that are world famous, yes, those are the best in the world. But for the rest of the system, for all of these, whether it's healthcare or higher education or retirement or any of them, we don't actually have results that are seemingly better. We just have less access. So when we talk about healthcare, right, we have these prices are so high, people are paying more, but you're not actually getting more for that. Whether it's Nexium you're getting in the UK or Nexium you're getting here, the same thing. We're just paying through the roof for it.
So let's turn to education. The U.S. spends far more on higher education than the OECD average, as the European countries, and more per student than any other country. The U.S. spends $22,744 per student on higher education in 2010, while the OECD average was $9,274.
So, yeah, I mean, anybody who's has to put a child through college or has been to college recently can tell you education, especially higher education in the U.S., is very expensive. And that goes both at the individual level, where tuition is rising and student debt is going up, as well as at the public level, where the government has stepped in. And because education is an important priority for individuals and for the country as a whole, has made it a priority to subsidize education. But as a proponent of education, I think that's important. It's just a question of how we do it. And I think it's a fairly strong argument to say that what we've done is sort of just added more fuel to this fire of subsidizing students to go to schools that are increasingly expensive. And again, the quality that you get out of it, in some cases, the education is better, but that only applies to a very small subset of the population. For most students at most of these schools, you see tuition going up. You see the government subsidy going up, but in terms of results of how many people are educating and in terms of what kind of quality education they're getting, it really, I don't think the data supports an idea that we're doing better. If anything, we're doing substantially worse.
Well, we know that student debt is higher than household debt, and it's growing, and then we have generations of students now that are in effect indentured. But right. when you say that the education is subsidized in this country, one of the things that I find appalling is the for-profit college industry, which is a racket, which is a result of our corrupt politics in Washington, where these lobbyists buy prominent Democrats and prominent Republicans and basically get bills passed to rip off the taxpayer. So we as taxpayers subsidize the for-profit college industry to the tune of about $30 to $40 billion a year. And they just rip off these kids, give them worthless diplomas and indentured to life, and spend a fortune on advertising on television with your and my taxpayers' money. I mean, isn't our money-driven politics a factor in why we pay more and get less?
I think it is. I don't think it's quite so simple as large amounts of money are swaying politics directly. But certainly in the education sphere, the higher education lobby that promotes the status quo in terms of how universities operate, they do have a lot of sway. But in general, I mean, you're always going to get a political system in which there are powers in that are going to push certain buttons. I think the bigger issue is just that we've gone so far down a certain path, and the response to trying to fix these issues for the politicians who do recognize that this social contract is a big issue and that people are struggling economically, the response has been to kind of add on more programs at the bottom, or like put little band-aids or patches on it, which does a little bit to help some people in the short term, but adds to the overall complexity of the system and how many, you know, end around turns and twists and opportunities there are for rent seeking, for people to kind of extract money out of it, take money for not really contributing to a better product. And that's a big part of why we see high costs and mediocre results. The systems are just very complicated, and the solutions to fixing the systems only add to the complexity rather than try to make them more understandable, more simple, and more direct to what they're trying to achieve.
But Joshua Friedman, you also talk about how, in terms of basic financial services, where a lot of people who don't have a lot of money, they find basic financial services are very high. And that has led, for example, to the proliferation of payday lenders, who are another example of what I was talking about earlier with the for-profit college. They have a powerful lobby in Washington. General Petraeus's wife managed to get the military, or get the Congress, to pass a bill, you know, shooing these predators away from military bases where they were preying on soldiers and getting them indentured. And that, again, is an example of where, you know, where our government's empowering bottom feeders but not dealing with, you know, making life for the middle class and working Americans better.
I agree with you, Ian, and I will add one thing, though, is that if you look at what payday lenders are doing, in a lot of cases, the alternative to some of these payday lenders who do have very, very high costs and fees and interest rates that are through the roof, the alternative for many people in certain communities is not that much better. The other banks that are there, the especially large banks, either don't offer services or offer sort of hidden fees that are similar and end up costing the same amount for people who have sort of volatile incomes or unstable finances. Even using regular banking products can be just as bad as using payday lending. But we've done nothing to actually try to fix that problem. One of the main responses has been to try to subsidize banks to do more of what they aren't otherwise doing in terms of offering products to low-income families. But that, again, just drives up costs. And at the end of the day, I don't think what we've seen is that that has been successful. What we see is just the rise of both payday lending and complex programs to try to convince banks to get into the low-income lending market rather than perhaps offering more direct, safer, maybe a public banking option, like a postal savings bank, for example, that could...
Which we used to have, by the way, Joshua, until the 1960s. Yeah.
And during the Great Depression, it was a big source of stability for families, and it did fade over time. Other countries do still have a postal banking system, some designed better than others, but certainly there are options for trying to tackle these problems in ways that would more directly address the problems that we see.
So let's turn to retirement and a safe retirement. Only 14% of all private sector workers have access to any kind of defined benefit pension, and that's down from 38% in 1979. So we're clearly heading in the wrong direction.
Well, so what we've seen is the overall number of people with access to any type of retirement plan has stayed the same. What's happened is that companies have shifted from defined benefit plans, where people get a specific pension payout monthly or annually at the end, and exchange that for defined contribution plans, where people have to put in the money themselves, put the money into markets or bonds or some investments, and then they just take out whatever is there. So what that does is it shifts the risk. The risk that was originally on the entire company is now on each individual. And if something goes wrong, the individual suffers. There's no risk pooling, or much less risk pooling than there would otherwise be. And so what you get is that system turns out to be a lot more costly for individuals, because if something goes wrong, there's nothing they can do, and it requires a much more time and effort and potentially, you know, taking on that risk of putting your money in the market or some other investment vehicle. And yeah, defined benefit pensions themselves had problems because they are expensive for employers. However, certainly safer for individuals. And if we're talking about economic insecurity, the amount of risk that the individuals are taking on and the amount of fees that Wall Street middlemen or financial advisors have taken trying to reallocate individual people's funds adds to the overall cost of the system. So people are spending a greater share of their retirement savings paying for people to invest their retirement rather than actually having them be safe in funds somewhere.
Well, let's just turn in the last couple of minutes then to the private sector. We've talked about banking, of course, which used to be, at least in terms of post offices, in the public sector. And the post office, of course, is going broke, so it could probably do with a bit of a boost there. I know Bernie Sanders has been trying to reintroduce post office banking. But the other thing that I think most of our listeners know about, and we're watching Time Warner and Comcast merge, and now AT&T and DirecTV merge, and yet in internet services, we are poster boys here in the United States for the pay more, get less model. At the highest internet speeds in the US, the US pays more than three times that of most of our peers and twice that of the OECD average. And anybody that has a cable package knows what lousy service you get and how they keep billing you for more. And if that model, if they get rid of net neutrality and they cableize the internet altogether, then we will truly, the country that invented the internet, will go back into the dark ages. I know I'm being a little dramatic here, but those are the facts.
I don't want to overuse anecdotes, but I know that when I was thinking about switching internet providers a few years ago, I looked at the cost and I was just shocked at what I thought were absurd prices that were charged for very basic services, nothing fancy, just basic, you know, decent speeds for a household of people. And it's true, we have very high prices, and our speeds are not better, our quality is not better necessarily than other countries. And it gets a little complicated in some of the differences, because the U.S. has a very large area and a very spread out population in places. So there are some issues, but I think it's pretty clear that the lack of a sufficient regulatory system to ensure fair prices and to make sure access is being widely distributed has contributed to the higher prices and not great service.
So just in conclusion then, Joshua Friedman, nearly every other peer nation outperforms the U.S. in terms of both public services and private services, in effect, where we pay more and get less. I mean, that's the bottom line.
Absolutely. And I think that you don't want to overuse comparisons, but it's pretty clear that other places have figured out on these various issues how to provide them more effectively than we have. And, you know, for a country that wants to promote its middle class, wants to ensure economic security for more people, this is not some random crazy idea, because the fact that almost everywhere has done it more effectively than us should serve as a clear sign that it is something that we wanted to do if we were to make the effort to design our programs much more simply, directly, and effectively.
But today there are primary elections going on in six states, with most of the debates are about the most extraneous, insane stuff that you can imagine. The New York Times has a very stinging editorial about it on Tuesday, indicating the absurdity of our political debate, where, you know, they're talking about denying global warming and obsessions with abortion, etc. Isn't that, at the end of the day, a part of the problem? That in the social democracies that you reference here, the OECD countries, people vote for public services, and if the government maintains these services and are good stewards of their money, they vote them back in. If they don't, they vote them out. In this country, we vote for people who don't do a damn thing for us, but distract us with all kinds of, you know, ideological and religious things like abortion. I mean, that's the part of it that I don't understand.
I don't know if I agree with you on this one. I think that other countries also have their political problems. If you look at, you know, France and the right-wing parties that are gaining traction there right now with Le Pen and some of the others, they certainly have their crazy issues as well. And if you look at the U.S. systems, the social programs and economic programs that we do have that are working well, things like Social Security, which has very low overhead costs and provides a majority of retirement income for a decent chunk of the senior population, those programs, if a politician threatens to even think about cutting them, they're immediately like kicked off the stage. So we do have some ability through our political system to, you know, keep in place the programs that are working. The issue, though, is trying to implement new programs. I don't think that people have any interest in actually recalibrating the programs, or they do have an interest in fighting about other things. The abstract size of the government, for example, which the abstract size, as I mentioned earlier, doesn't make sense because it doesn't say anything about what we're actually getting or what we actually need. So instead of concentrating on how big the government or how small the government, we should concentrate on what kind of services and social protections and ways of providing economic security sure. the government can do effectively, and then ensuring that the people who need these services, which at this point is the broad middle class, to boost their quality of life, making sure that the government actually is doing it in an effective manner.
Well, if we had an effective opposition to the Republicans in this country who keep talking about big government, and if the Democrats would talk about, no, that's a canard, let's talk about better government, maybe we'd be getting somewhere.
I agree with you, and I would hope that we can have that debate at some point. But obviously the small government talking points seem to continue to be effective, despite, I think, just standing in the way of actually getting to a better system.
Well, Joshua Friedman, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Ian.
We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the VA healthcare system, now embroiled in a scandal that compared to the overall U.S. healthcare system that kills 225,000 Americans a year, is widely recognized as leading the nations in terms of both quality and costs.